The gods must be crazy playwrights, right? Written and read by Fresney, Fandoms, Sherlock BBC, and a very messed up version of Greek mythology. Warnings for Omegaverse, and a whole lot of ridiculousness. Part of the Variations on an Equation series. This particular entry is Male Alpha Sherlock, Other John. Sadly, they don't really go by those names in this story, but I'm hoping you'll figure out who they are. Where it was a generally acknowledged truth among the Argonauts that there was only truly one gender. Jason was the one who understood this, which was an opinion he expressed at length. It should also be understood that during long sea journeys, such as the Argonauts underwent, there wasn't much to do at night but look at the stars, discuss natural philosophy, and fornicate with each other. Jason would say to Hercules, "During heat, if the heat is not sufficiently hot, then the child that results will be a beta. For what results on presentation is unbaked." Hercules would grunt at this point, for Jason was generally thrusting between his oil-slicked thighs as he said this. For Jason greatly enjoyed mixing natural philosophy with fornication, while Hercules stargazed. Orpheus, who had dedicated himself to the pursuit of music, would increase the noise of play upon his lyre, and replay within his mind palace the song of the sirens, who, he smiled to remember, had lost in competition when he played against them. Of the some 50 other heroes upon the Argos, they went to whichever of the options available to them pleased them most. Although some few stuffed their ears with wax, Jason paid none of them mind. He would thrust mightily and continue. "If too hot, then an omega will result, for that which presents is overcooked." Hercules would whine, because Jason had bound him to prevent him from touching his own alpha phallus. And by Jason's thrusting between his thighs, he was greatly roused. And it was a strain for Hercules not to casually break the bonds that his captain had placed on him. "If right in temperature, then the alpha is produced, that there are women of each." He would reach around and playfully flick the base of Hercules' knot. "This comes if the heat is too moist." He would grip Hercules then, "and men if the moisture was just right." At this, Jason increased the speed of his words and the rhythm of his thrusts. Orpheus, to his chagrin, set his tempo to those actions, and attempted to shift his focus to the stars. Hercules whined around the gag in his mouth. Jason slapped his backside, which he had earlier greatly reddened with an oar before they began. This had the effect of quieting Hercules in anticipation. "For women are but men." With this he would stroke a groan from Hercules, were their organs internally arranged, then leave off stroking again to Hercules' whine, "and omegas and betas are but alphas, with their sense but variations on an alphas." The pace of his thrusting increased, either too cool and increased, or too hot. It was then that natural philosophy generally made way, as Jason spent himself, and by a tap, let Hercules know he could break his bonds and please himself. It may at this juncture be right to point out that Atalanta had been asked to join their party, but as she was an Omega, she told them, "Join an all-alpha crew? You can all fuck yourselves and die at that idea. You'd be constantly dropping golden apples, hoping I'd pick them up." But it was said that she'd conceived an enmity for Orpheus, for she could have forgiven his pride if his pride had not injured hers. It should also be noted that just as Hercules fell into the torpor that always took him after he spread his seed, since the gods are great playwrights in that way, it was in this moment that the ship was overtaken by some 100 pirates, each of them descendants of Hermes and Aphrodite, which is why they are called the Hermaphrodites. True to their names, they carry the scent of Alpha, Omega, and Beta, and had the phalluses of men and the breasts of women,
and could generate life both by the spreading of seed and bearing the seedlings of planting.
Jason complained bitterly on this point, and would have roused Hercules, but he'd already roused him far too well. When Orpheus' mind descended from his mind palace, where he had retreated during Jason's philosophizing with Hercules, and noticed that he'd been captured, he said to his captor, "Are you an Alpha, Omega, or Beta?" His captor, whose name was Eurydice, said, "Yes." Which, since that clearly hadn't been a yes or no question, was answer enough.
The very idea was an intriguing inspiration.
Orpheus trailed his bound fingers in the sand until he found two shells, and the sound that he made from them was a rhythm that sounded like an Omega's scent in high heat. Eurydice smiled to hear it. Now, the hermaphrodites were after a particular sort of piracy. They, like the Amazons, liked to couple with travelers, that they might bring fresh blood among their band. So they each selected from among the heroes the ones they wished to couple with, and coupled per their preferences. Now, as the Argonauts numbered 50, and there were some 100 hermaphrodites, well, there were some multiple selections. Now Eurydice had Herm's eye firmly on Orpheus, and more importantly, Herm's ears tuned to the deep melody of his voice. Eurydice said to Orpheus, "Have you an Omega friend?"
"No," said Orpheus.
"Have you an Alpha friend?" said Eurydice, who, being no soothsayer, was attempting to divine Orpheus's preferences.
"Not really my area," replied Orpheus,
who had found two sticks with his toes and had set to tapping them together in a rhythmic manner that was an Alpha's beat in rut. Eurydice smiled to hear it. But then Orpheus suddenly understood the tenor of Eurydice's questions. Most of the Argonauts had withdrawn to the white-painted homes of the hermaphrodites, but as the cries from their open windows alluded, were engaged in vigorous rut with the hermaphrodites, who, as is the norm of this type of adventure, were all in heat, having well prayed for the pleasure of it. Eurydice, who had held off praying to Hermes and Aphrodite until Herm could determine Orpheus's preference, smiled, "Whichever is fine, by the way." Orpheus said very slowly, "You should know, I consider myself dedicated to music." He had by then pressed the sand beneath his heels quite flat, and was set to slapping a Beta's patient rhythm from the earth as he tapped the sticks and rubbed the shells.
"That's fine," said Eurydice,
who prayed fervently to Apollo, who had been pleased by Herm's smiles at Orpheus's song. Herm was blessed to make music with Orpheus upon the beach. Orpheus sang, "Oh," as Apollo blessed him, as they discovered that Orpheus was pleased to rut with an Alpha. Phallus clasped a phallus, knots swelling, seeds spent upon their chest that gleamed like a pearl, that Orpheus was pleased to knot with an Omega's Charybdis, seed well caught, that Orpheus was pleased to be pinned beneath an Alpha, tiny cilia that gripped as tight as the scylla, that Orpheus was pleased to suckle upon a Beta's breasts or a Beta's phallus, that Orpheus was overall well pleased, and Eurydice was greatly pleased, the blessings of Apollo showered on them like sunbeams. Orpheus, by his music, so encouraged the others. That is, except Hercules, who slept through all of this, and Jason, because the hermaphrodites believed him to be bonded to Hercules, and no amount of rhetoric on Jason's part could convince them otherwise. So when all had been well pleased, the hermaphrodites set the Argonauts back on the Argus and bid the fathers of their children goodbye. All except Phileus, son of Dionysus, for he had secretly been an Omega, and having been well bred, must now stay until his vintage was delivered. In truth, he raised a vineyard there, and pressed many vintages among the hermaphrodites, and was well known for his devotedness to prayer. All except Eurydice. Orpheus trailed his fingers across his lyre and said, "As a pirate, you've seen your share of trouble." "Too much," said Eurydice, licking Herm's lips. Orpheus tapped a steady rhythm on the deck to a significant tune. "Would you like to see more?" Eurydice said, "Oh, gods, yes," and leapt onto the deck. Now, the Argonauts were, for the most part, spent, having well rutted among the hermaphrodites. All but for Hercules, who had slept through it, all but for Jason, who had spent his time among the hermaphrodites in philosophical frustration. Jason plagued Orpheus to let him couple with Eurydice. Orpheus looked up annoyed from a song that he was composing on the variations of coupling and said, "Why are you speaking to me?" Eurydice, who was knitting boots for Herm's little ones, Herm had every expectation of twins, looked up. Herm tapped the sharp needles together and smiled. "You're welcome to try." At which Jason would withdraw and seek out Hercules, who sulked at his approach, and would not discuss philosophy with him, having heard his earlier plaguing. Jason was forced to take comfort with the ghosts of Phrixus, for the Argos was haunted, which, although it was the reason for the trip, had not much bearing on anything, and thus had cold comfort indeed. They had several further adventures along the way. Each of the 50 heroes was given a chance to shine. Through all of this, one-eyed giants and the bird women and the attack of the Priapi, cousins to the hermaphrodites, but far less pleasant in their approach, Eurydice greatly enjoyed himself, and ever swelled as a sign of the passing of time. Though many of these adventures could have been avoided if Jason had been of a different nature, it was in this mood that they arrived in Colchis, where the golden fleece was kept. Jason stepped onto the sand, which should have shuddered at his touch, but it did not. He was greeted by Medea, who was princess and priestess both, who had foreseen his arrival by her dark arts. Alas, for all of them, she did not look far enough ahead. He greeted her thus, "Hello, beautiful. Want to find a temple where we can discuss natural philosophy beneath the stars?" Hercules sniffed and sulked at these words. Medea said, "Indeed, let us break bread and discuss the natural order of things." Jason and Medea went up to a temple to Hecate, who was the goddess to whom Medea had dedicated herself. Medea poured dark wine sweetened with spices. She picked up a small hand broom and slapped it against her palm. As Hecate is the goddess of three faces, she is the goddess of the genders who are one. If the worship of Hecate is pleasing to you, then it would please me to be pleased by you. Jason held in his hand a small oar that marked him as a sailor. He slapped it against his palm. "It is pleasing." What they both meant by this was to a large degree the source of their later difficulties. But on that night, the moon was a hungry sliver in the sky, and the black ewe that bleated had but one more cry to give. Medea cut the throat of the black ewe and threw it in the holocaust by the altar. She poured a libation of honey upon the fire, saying, "I sacrifice the innocent and the sweet." In the distance, there was a sound of wild dogs. Medea said, "The goddess is pleased. As she is the goddess of the crossroads, she is the goddess of choice." She held up a rope. "Would you give up your choice to me?" Now, Jason's tendencies were generally in a different direction, but having been sulked at by Hercules for some time, said yes. He waited impatiently for Medea to finish her foolish ritual, her questions about the acts that would please, and those which would be too far, her endless words on what word he should call out if he wished for her to stop. For the goddess is pleased by choice. Jason ceased listening until she struck him with her broom and commanded his attention. Finally, she tied him up and struck him with her broom, until his backside was quite reddened. She used the rope, too. She was well versed in its use. Through all of this, Jason was impatient, but she made him wait. Finally, she took him by her way of thinking, for she was on top. By his way of thinking, he took her, for it was his oar that rode within her. This was the source of some of their many difficulties later. Medea, in turn, was pleased to enjoy the oar of Jason, not the hand oar, but the other, which by her magic she rode in her body until the hungry moon set in the sky. On that night, they were well pleased. Jason was even more greatly pleased to find Medea was accomplished in magics, and by his discourse convinced her to assist him in gaining the golden fleece. Now as to the trials Jason went through to gain the golden fleece, from Medea's father much has been told. How Medea aided him in burying dragon's teeth to raise an army. How she gave him the balm he needed to withstand the fire-breathing oxen, that they might be yoked to a task. How she gave him what herbs were needed to bring sleep to a sleepless dragon. To these things this story must only allude. It is sufficient to say that Medea was so taken with Jason that on their flight with the golden fleece, she raised a knife to the throat of her most beloved brother and cut that throat that she might cast a spell upon the wind and take the Argos to safety. That Jason did not take the full meaning of her choice was the source of some of their difficulties later. But that was to be later. At that time, he merely laughed at the power of his hold over her. Once well away, the Argonauts put to shore on a fair island to take up supplies. The centaurs there greeted them kindly and offered them bread and wine. Orpheus, seeing Eurydice in Apollo's light, said, "Medea, as you are a priestess, can you put the blessing of bond upon myself in Eurydice?" Medea could, but as Orpheus hadn't said a word of this to Eurydice before this, there was some argument on this point. They argued on the beach that Eurydice would have liked to have been asked. They argued down the beach that Orpheus had already asked. They argued up the beach that this conversation had taken place in Orpheus's head and not on the beach. Then there was the disagreement about Eurydice's original act of piracy, which Herm had to accept was a fair point, but pointed out that Orpheus had not protested. In the end, Eurydice asked Orpheus to bond, but was told not to be confusing, and then yes. By nightfall, Medea had bonded them together by the power of Hecate, while the waves made music with the shore. Now Jason was most unhappy at this turn. He still had a desire to experience a hermaphrodite. So he asked Medea for a spell that he could take on her appearance. He told her it was for the purpose of coupling later, and Medea was sufficiently intrigued to provide it. So Jason, as Medea, pulled Eurydice away from the feast that the centaurs had laid out and attempted to trifle with Herm. Eurydice said, "I'm very flattered, but you did just officiate at my bonding." Then, because the gods are predictable playwrights, Herm stepped backwards onto a serpent and was fatally struck. Jason left Herm there and pretended he'd been merely nearby, exploring his temporary female form. Hercules looked at him coolly, though, and Medea's expression was also somewhat thoughtful. Now Orpheus was quite distraught. He would not let them burn Eurydice's body. He told the Argonauts instead to wait for him. He went into a cave and threw it down into the underworld. He played upon his lyre a sweet song, and Hades' great dog Cerberus fell asleep. He came to the gates of Adamantine and opened them with his voice and a knock. Orpheus truly was the greatest musician who ever was, and was much blessed by Apollo. Orpheus came to the court of Hades and played upon his lyre. He played for the adventures that he and Eurydice had had, and the ones they would never have. He sang of the looks that he'd cast Eurydice when her wasn't looking, and of the kisses they'd exchanged with closed eyes. He sang to them how in every shifting world Eurydice was the one constant point. Persephone, whose heart was very soft with possibilities, said, "Oh, their love is so true." She turned to Hades, whose heart was hard with justice and the weight of souls, and took his hand, which she placed upon her breast. "Please, let him take his love back to the sunlit world above." Hades' heart softened at her touch, if perhaps something else grew hard in compensation. Hades allowed that Orpheus could return, but that Eurydice would walk behind him all the long way, and that if Orpheus looked back, then Eurydice would stay. And further, if he failed, Orpheus could not return to ask for Herm. With a happy heart, Orpheus set out, sure in his task. With his sharp ears, he listened for Herm's footsteps on the ground, but they did not make a rhythm. He listened for the song of Herm's breathing, but there was none. Now Orpheus was the world's greatest musician, but he was also by nature very curious. He held out all the long road, but at the last moment, he could not stand not knowing. He turned back just at the opening of the cave. Eurydice shook Herm's head ruefully and headed back the way Herm had come. Now, some stories would have it that Orpheus stopped there, that he went on his way and sang sorrowful songs until he was ripped apart by Maenads, who only wished for him to play something cheerful for once. But that would have been some other story. Here, he turned right back around again. For Orpheus had not become the world's greatest musician just on Apollo's blessing. He had played until his fingers grew calloused, and tuned his voice by using his chest as bellows. He once more set the great three-headed dog that guarded the gate to sleeping. He once more opened the adamantine gate with a knock and a song. He came to the court of Hades, where he found Hades and Persephone had cast aside their robes and turned Persephone's throne to a different use. That Persephone, who also goes by the name of Kore when she is a beta, and Hecate when she is an alpha, had bent Hades over the arm of her throne, and was sweetly pressing into him with her alpha aspect. Hades groaned. Then Orpheus cleared his throat, and Hades opened his eyes. "You again? Oh, my lady!" which was addressed to Hecate, who had done something quite unseen within him. Orpheus cleared his throat. Hades groaned for a different reason. "I said you could not come. Oh, my lady, back for Eurydice if you failed. Sweet spring above!" Orpheus was prepared for this argument, if not for this sight. He said, "I'm not here for Eurydice." He played a song for his daughter or son, yet to be. He sang of scraped knees and terrors. He sang of starlit nights as young eyes learned the wheel of stars across the Milky Way. "Oh," said Hecate, whose heart was soft with possibilities, "that's so sad, losing your children before they were even born." She stroked Hades even as she stroked within him. "He was bonded by my priestess. Let him take his children up to the starlit world above." Now, though Hades' heart was hard with the wheel of justice, Hades sighed, for he was in no way capable of refusing that request. Nor, for that matter, the way Hecate was stroking him. Orpheus coughed. As it happens, my children are currently growing within Eurydice, so necessarily Herm will need to come too. As well, we are to have twins, so if I must return, then I will only be returning for the child that you do not now release back into the world. Hades groaned, for this was exactly the reason that he didn't care to do this sort of thing in the first place. He said, "For you only, but this time you must carry Eurydice, and oh sweet spring!" at something Hecate had done within him. "But all the while you journey, Herm will be pleasing you. If you spend yourself before you reach the top, you all stay." Because gods can be like that. Orpheus tossed his curling head of hair and bent that Eurydice might climb upon his back. So bent half over, with Eurydice's hands stroking upon him, he made his way back to the world above. He did not spend himself before he reached the top, but it was a near thing several times. When they did reach the world above, Eurydice climbed back into Herm's body, and as it happened, had only been gone a few hours, and as their bonding was yet unconsummated, and both were more than ready, they fell to consummating each other beside the pyre that was to have been for Eurydice's funeral. Later, much later, Medea was thoughtful when Eurydice said to her, "No hard feelings, but I'm bonded to Orpheus, and he did journey into the underworld for me. Twice." This last was said with a quirk of Eurydice's lips, for this was also the number of consummations they had just enjoyed. Medea was thoughtful on this. She was thoughtful all the journey to Aeclus, where she and Jason were to be bonded, after some few adventures. But when it came time to crown Jason, she said, "My love, I should place the crown upon your brow." She did not say, for she was a priestess of Hecate, for that was obvious. Jason said, "My love, I must crown myself." He did not say, for he was an alpha, for that was obvious. This was then the source of some of their disagreements later, but in that moment with the pregnant moon overhead, they crowned each other. As to Orpheus and Eurydice, they left the moment they arrived, and went in another direction entirely, where, as it happened, as they were walking along the shore, they were almost attacked by Maenads. But Eurydice said, "Hari, is that you?" And as it turned out, while the gods had nothing against siblings ripping each other apart for a good joke, the madness left the Maenads. And Eurydice brewed up a nice tea on the holocaust of Dionysus. And as it turned out, while the gods had nothing against siblings ripping each other apart for a good joke, the madness left the Maenads, and Eurydice brewed up a nice tea on the holocaust of Dionysus for Herm's sibling, and they all had a nice chat about what they'd been up to. Orpheus, who might have been described by some as all head, did in fact have a heart, composed a song for the occasion. It was admittedly called "Ode to Joy at Not Being Dismembered," and not one of his best efforts, but still a lovely melody. He was, after all, the greatest musician who ever lived, and could make simply reciting a list of names into a song. The end.